You're listening to a podcast of Spurious Morality.
And welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. You rejoin us for our Caves of Androzani commentary. We did parts one and two last week, so we're going to do parts three and four in this episode. I am rejoined by my same fellow spodcasters as last time, so big hello to Greg.
Hello again.
And hello to Mark.
Hi.
Sorry, Mark. Greg got a big hello. You just got hello. Don't know why.
I don't take it too personally.
Yeah, honestly, it's nothing personal. So the plan is we're going to watch parts three and four of The Caves of Androzani. As I said, we've already done parts one and two. We're going to pause in between episodes. So if you want to watch along with us at home, we'll give you a countdown. We'll tell you when to press play. And then, like I say, we'll have a little pause between parts three and four so we can give you a press play instruction again. For those of you that watch the DVDs and Blu-rays with episode selection, which I do, I quite like it. I like that pause, and if I've fallen asleep, it means that it doesn't go an extra three, four, five episodes, which is always helpful.
Yes, I'm an episode selecting guy as well. Never go for the play all option.
No, never. It's genuinely the best feature on those DVDs and Blu-rays. And I do apologise to all of the wonderful people that make the additional content and the documentaries and so on. But select episode, that's the winner. That's what I'm on the Blu-ray for. Okay then, so we'll without any further ado, we will watch the third episode of Caves of Androzani. So I will give you a countdown, a 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 countdown. So go on one, and we'll start episode three, or part three, I should say. Press play in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Let's go. I still feel as though we should have some special title sequence. I know I said this last week, but Davison's last story, I just want something slightly different.
Well, you do get it in the end credits for episode four.
That's true. They're unique, aren't they? It's not the normal Colin ones that we get. It's sort of a hybrid between the two.
Kind of sticks his face on it that just sits there for a couple seconds. Yeah.
With him smiling just like he wasn't on screen 5 seconds before, or indeed for the 90 minutes after.
I've been waiting a week to see how the Doctor will get out of this.
I know, that magma beast is just terrifying.
It's immune to bullets.
Just to show that they're firing bullets, we've got more of that that sort of ripply effect.
Yeah, the microphony, I believe it's called.
You know, I actually looked that up and tried to memorize it before we did this, and I have completely forgotten it, which is hence it being that bullet effect, that ripply effect.
I'll let you be
the dictionary.
I think that's kind of an interesting summation of the story there, actually. Like, there's this, you know, the cliffhanger is like the Doctor is being threatened by the magma beast, but actually what happens is he just hides and the magma beast goes and deals with someone else and he just runs away, which is basically the whole story in microcosm.
The Doctor and Perry have absolutely no impact on this story at all, really, do they? I suppose other characters make decisions based on their presence and errors about their presence, but that's basically it.
Yeah, that is true. It's kind of like, is it Indiana Jones that we say that about? That in Raiders, he basically just goes through the whole thing having no actual impact on events. He just witnesses them.
Yeah, I mean, they would have opened the Ark of the Covenant either way, and yeah.
Yeah. But there is something kind of satisfying about a story in which just there's no... You've just stumbled into this nasty little local war, as he describes it, and there's just no... There's nothing to be done other than survive it. You know, it's such a rare thing for the Doctor to have no impact whatsoever, but getting out alive is... Well, getting up, even he doesn't get out alive, really. But it's all there is to be salvaged from it.
I think isn't every single male character killed in this story?
I believe so. Yeah,
I think so. Yeah,
I think we've got two female characters, both of whom survive. But I think every single male character is killed.
Trying to think of other stories where the Doctor just has like no control. I mean, I guess Midnight's an example of that.
Yeah.
I mean, he tries to take control of it in the beginning, and then it obviously goes spectacularly wrong.
Legopolis, maybe. Well, I suppose he does stop the Master in the end, doesn't he? But gets himself killed in the process. But Traken would have ended up being wiped out either way.
I remember being really shocked by that. That sudden slap up the face there for Davison when I first watched this on VHS. 100 years ago now. It's such a brutal story compared to what we normally get. The Doctor doesn't generally get that kind of how you describe it. Like, just there's just extra level of unexpected violence.
It's season 22 is the one that gets credited as being, or criticised, I suppose, as being the violent one, but I think this is actually heavier than anything we get there. Maybe, you know, Cybermen crushing Lytton's hands as the exception, but this is like really, really nasty and brutal.
Mm. Well, so is a Resurrection of the Daleks, actually. Like, I think
very
both,
true, yeah.
Both that and this are probably darker than anything in season 22.
I read not that long ago that Resurrection actually has a higher body count than Terminator.
I think the thing about season 22, though, is the Doctor is more, there's more violence from the Doctor in that one. Like, I mean, he smothers somebody with cyanide or something at one point. Not cyanide.
Yeah, kills Shockeye in the two Doctors, yeah. Doesn't he?
Yeah, it is cyanide from the butterfly.
Yeah, so it started to get a bit more like, at least in Androzani, the Doctor's clearly still trying to get through it in as gentlemanly a fashion as he can, you know, but it's just not going to work.
Or in Resurrection, where all he has to do is shoot Davros, and that's the one thing he like can't do. Yeah. You assume that if that had been Colin Baker's Doctor, you'd have just gleefully blown him away, but I don't know for sure. You know, at least as written by Eric Saward.
Yeah, that would be the crucial factor, wouldn't it? If Eric was writing him, no compunction for Colin.
I suppose it's Davison's "Do I Have the Right" moment, isn't it?
It is.
The Davros thing. And then two regenerations later, McCoy is, "I have the right and I'm going to shout about it. Bye bye, Scaro." I suppose the biggest impact that the Doctor and Perry have on this story is they help Saladin escape from Shara's Jek, and therefore Saladin's able to give the rest of the soldiers the location of his base. And I suppose that kind of accelerates everything that's going on a little bit. But that's the closest I can think of.
Yeah, that's true. This is... Yeah, you start to see how serious things are getting for the Doctor here. He's saying, "Leave me to die," but you know, knowing the Doctor, he would find some extra reserves of energy to drag himself back and work on a solution. But it's kind of unclear.
Indeed,
he thinks he might not be able to go, literally might not be able to go on, or if it's a ruse. But he's definitely struggling.
Well, he sort of holds off the regeneration at the end of this episode, doesn't he?
Oh yeah, the little Ripley effect that you see him.
Yeah.
Kind of
when he's tied up on the ship, he's ready to go, and he kind of hangs on to save Perry. We've had sort of the idea of regeneration being held off a few times since this now. So we had it with, I suppose, the 10th, 11th, and 12th Doctors, and to an extent, 13th.
Retrospectively, the first.
Yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Of course. But particularly, the 12th Doctor, just he holds it off to have an entire extra adventure.
Kind of implied with the 3rd Doctor also, because he, you know, is in the TARDIS traveling for however long.
Oh, yeah. He wanted to get home, didn't he? Whereas the 4th Doctor falls off Jodrell Bank and 2 minutes later he's Peter Davison. There's no messing about there.
Right.
This is definitely the best example, and I think it's kind of from this moment onwards, really. It's the best example of the Doctor holding off regeneration and what that means and how serious it actually is. And I don't think it's ever been done this well since.
I love the lighting in this ship.
There's no other ship that looks like it in all of Doctor Who, and I do like that.
I can't remember if I said this last week, but the little thing just above the chair there in the background, it always looks to me almost like a little skull in profile or something. It's like this little accidental memento mori just sort of hovering over all these people who are fated to die. Including, in a way, the Doctor. Nobody who's in that cockpit comes out of it and survives.
I love how he needed the blindfold removing.
Oh, yeah.
Morgus needs the blindfold removing to recognise the Doctor.
Yeah, because that costume's so indistinct. Like, isn't it?
How many
other
people...
That could be any guy with celery on his jacket.
How many other people are knocking about an Androzani minor ready to play cricket?
Mind you, if you can believe it, of one person, it would be Morgus, because he's so... I don't think he's so fixated on what he wants that he's not noticing the trappings of what other people might be wearing or otherwise. It's just, have I spoken to this guy? Actually, did he only witness the Doctor in the red cloak of death or whatever prior to this, or no
there was the big show him to me moment,
doesn't need to be. Yeah,
I've just realized, I mean, I've seen this god knows how many times before, but I've just realized we never see Morgus blink.
Oh, yeah.
I love the little asides to camera.
That's what he does instead of blinking.
I always thought Davison's second costume was never quite as good as the first one. There's something baggier about the coat. It doesn't look quite as fitted or tailored or something. And it always annoys me slightly. But anyway.
As far as Doctor costume changes go, it's still the most subtle.
It is. It is. It seems to be a slightly lighter color as well. It just doesn't look as good.
I do quite like it when a Doctor's costume gets varied. Sort of when you watch Pertwee's first two seasons versus his last three. Like in season 7, he has a fixed costume. In season 8, he's got a couple of tops, but it's the same basic fixed costume. Whereas from that point onwards, it's almost like a different colour jacket every story.
Yeah, which is a really nice... Well, a bit of variation, but it also kind of ties in with his slightly going native increasingly. There's something in that original Pertwee costume. It's like, I'm not sticking around. I'm going to get gone as soon as I can. So, you know, he doesn't even bother really changing his look up much because he's not expecting to be. Whereas by the end of Pertwee's time, he's got a job. He's living there. For all we know, he's got a house. The comic strips imply he had a house. So he probably just, probably expanded his wardrobe accordingly. He's so polite, isn't he? Doesn't even turn his head to say hello.
The way he's directed to perform just shouldn't work, but it does. Like, he really pulls it off. Graham Harper really pulls it off.
Yeah.
So theoretically, that whole asides to camera and playing it very sort of Iago-like, it really, really shouldn't work on BBC TV on a Tuesday, Wednesday night, something like that.
Thursday, Friday, I believe.
Oh, was it? Yep.
But I think it was Tuesdays and Wednesdays for the first two Davison seasons, and then this one with Thursday, Friday. I looked it up recently to remind myself.
See, this bit's great as well. He actually burns himself.
Yeah.
Like any other Doctor Who story, he cuts through first time faultlessly. But this is the Caves of Androzani. The Doctor has got to get hurt.
He's got to get hurt, that's right.
Well, he's in the process of dying, so...
Yeah, we'll give him a pass.
Mind you, it's very lightweight. If you compare that to any Kate Orman book, that's having a nice day.
Well, yeah, if you want to talk about a story where everyone dies, anything by Jim Mortimer, too.
Yes, when I say that this is the most brutal Doctor Who's ever got, and what I mean is this is the most brutal Doctor Who's ever got on screen.
Yeah. That's true.
I'm not entirely sure what wins off screen. I think Just War's in with a shout.
A nice little QWERTY keyboard there, controlling all the flight maneuvers.
In space, no one can hear you type.
You see, this guy's been back and forth about, what, 4 times now, one day? The Presidium must just be really, it must be just next door.
I kind of like the implication that the president and possibly even the Presidium don't actually have any power at all. And, you know, they go to Morgus, not Morgus goes to them.
Yeah.
And, of course, we do find that he's fairly easy to murder.
Yeah, a bit gullible, this guy. Just took his eye off the ball.
And off the empty elevator shaft.
Yeah. Now that is a good effect for 1984, isn't it? Like the way he spins on the way down there.
I am deeply distressed.
Oh yeah. What story, which article story is it? It's the rescue, isn't it, where the two guys fall down the shaft and it's just like two little 2D bits of paper or something falling down there.
Mm-hmm.
They've come a long way since then.
I'm sure somebody needs to put together a compilation video of falls in Doctor Who.
Well, if it had been the Pertwee era, he would have shoved him off of a large mound in a quarry, and the stuntman would have leapt off of it.
We had a fun take on that recently, didn't we? In the giggle, because the building is so tall that I think the guys were still falling when they were referred to having been pushed off.
Probably another example of the most brutal Doctor Who's ever got, just it was done to a Spice Girls track, which kind of takes the tension out of it a little bit. Pretty sure the amount of flashes they've got on that screen is pushing the BBC Micro as far as possible.
Yeah, that's... That's it working flat out.
So it seems that Jack could kind of come and go from the military base as much as he wanted. He obviously had a secret way in. Because that's how we will have snatched the Doctor and Perry in the first episode, and Perry again now. So why didn't he just sneak in, plant a bomb, clear off, end the war?
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, when you start breaking it down, you know, the fact that everything is so close here, I mean, it seems like any side in this could realistically have just wiped the other one out.
Maybe he was concerned about reprisals for such a dramatic action. We'll go with that. This is mega creepy stuff.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Like the villain fancying the companion has been done before and will be done again, but this is definitely the best version of it.
Because it's being played so straight. And we mentioned it in the last commentary, but Nicola Bryant really sells this.
Yeah, it's a real tour de force. Like, she's so new to this show, and yeah, she just, I don't know, she just pulls off very convincing terror, like complete, like, oh, there we are. There's the regeneration.
There's the blur.
Yeah.
But you kind of got that desperation out of her in Planet of Fire as well. Like, she started really, really strong. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a shame. Planet of Fire is, it's much more a Turlough story than it is a Perry story, even though it's Perry's first story. And she does spend what feels like half of it just running around Lanzarote trying to get away from Chameleon. But she plays that really well.
This is a cliffhanger.
Yeah,
I do like the fact that there's no messing about cutting that door open. If this was the right. Daleks, that's 10 minutes. That's half an episode. This is no 20 seconds, doors open, guns on the Doctor. And that shot through the door's excellent.
Davison's finest moment here.
Absolutely. That's got to be one of the best cliffhangers ever.
Oh, that's so good.
As has part one.
I remember one time hearing that there's two types of Doctor Who fan. There's the people who look through the credits, and then there's the people who look at the credits. I think I'm both. I've never entirely memorized every person involved, but I've got my reassuring old favorites here, like Alec Wheel and Don Babbage.
There's a lot of people who worked on an awful lot of classic Doctor Who really don't get the credit they deserve because they are buried in sort of two thirds of the way through an end credit sequence.
Yeah. And then there's the ones that don't even get mentioned at all. And you have to switch on the production titles on the DVD to even see them given a little final mention, you know, after decades, they get their little credit.
I think a lot of the DVD documentaries have done a good job of emphasizing the work of some of the lesser known, you know, members of the crew. Not everybody, of course, there's no way, but they've definitely made an effort.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the big question is, are we ready for part four?
After that cliffhanger, I think so.
I nearly said imagine having to wait a week, but you didn't. You had to wait 24 hours on original broadcast, didn't you?
That's right.
I wonder if that kind of ruined it at the time, because I like cliffhanger. I like waiting to find out what's going to happen next week, and obviously we don't get that near enough every week with New Who. But I don't know, what do we think people at the time preferred? Did they prefer the usual once a week on Saturday or the 2 weekday ones with Davison?
Well, I think there was still just enough time for playground conversation, and maybe there was even a wee bit of increased hype because it's like, oh, you know, instead of a week to sort of talk about it on the Monday after the Saturday, it was like, did you see Doctor Who last night? What's going to happen tonight? You know, there might have been a bit of extra frisson to it. I'm trying to remember. I'm old enough that I should be able to remember, but I can't really recall.
Well, I didn't consume Doctor Who this way, so I cannot contribute.
Well, the first time I saw this was the DVD, so I definitely can't. I think I binged it all in one go and thought, wow.
First time I saw pretty much everything, it was the old the omnibus format that we had in the US. And so we didn't even have cliffhangers. You would just have like that moment and then like just a really sloppy edit, like cutting out the reprise and putting you into the next episode.
I remember the first few VHS releases were like that too. It was so annoying because you really want those cliffhanger moments. And then when they finally switched to just releasing them episodically on VHS, that was a big watershed moment. I was like, yes.
Until the DVD came out, I had only ever seen the VHS version of Revenge of the Cybermen. And so as I got a bit older and I was aware that the cliffhangers had been edited out, I actually used to play a game of, where do I think the cliffhanger would have been then? And when you watch it back, they're all really obvious, but actually they weren't at the sort of when I was younger and having never seen them at all.
Well, imagine trying that with Death to the Daleks.
Oh, fantastic. Anyway, we're going to be nice and we're not going to make our listeners wait a whole week or even a whole day. We're going to move on to the Caves of Androzani Part 4. So your 5-second warning is incoming. Are you both ready to go?
Yep.
Let me know when.
Okay. Press play in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Let's go. And arguably one of the best individual episodes of Doctor Who ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm so pleased that it's my favourite Doctor that has that honour.
Last week we were talking about, you know, how viewers at the time must have sort of been like, it can be like this. This is what it can be like. That's how I felt when I first saw this episode. It was very much like, isn't there more Doctor Who like this? Sort of in a minute with the Doctor running across the planet and being shot at left, right and centre. Just, it's incredible. It seems fairly simple as an action sequence by today's standards, but considering the restraints of filming in the mid-80s, it's just incredible that they made it look so good and that it was so well-paced and full of energy. And but all of this, even this in the studio, the hurtling towards the planet, the door cutting open, it's just so quick-paced.
Isn't that one of Graham Harper's famous catchphrases? Lots of pace and energy.
Yes,
he was heard to say that a lot on the studio floor, which itself was unusual, even for those guys, for him to be there, you know, right down on studio floor level with the actors was incredibly atypical, wasn't it?
I think it's something that Revelation of the Daleks, obviously Graham Harper's other classic story, does very, very well too. It takes a while to get to the action in that one. But when the action kicks in, it's just as good as this. It's a bit more of a talky story. There's a lot of planning, backstabbing you type stuff going on. But when we do get to the action, it really does go for it. But yeah, just Davison legging it through the desert here. It's absolutely brilliant.
No, nobody runs quite like Davison. Maybe Tennant.
Wouldn't surprise me if Tennant deliberately ran like Davison while he was in the role.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely see like how excited Harper is to get on film, because when you're doing single camera like that, you can do all those cool, you know, Doctor running to the camera and the bullets exploding in the sand in front of him, like that kind of stuff that there's just absolutely no way to do in a studio.
I think just compare it to, even from the same season, compare it to the running around scenes in The Awakening. Now, The Awakening's a good story. It's a pretty fast-paced story. It's only a two-parter. But the stuff on film, it does feel a little bit laggy compared to this.
Right.
You've got Tegan running around in heels and it's all just like, you know, click, clop, click, clop, click, clop, click. There's no desperation. There's no energy to it. Whereas this is, you're genuinely feeling like, good God, the Doctor is running for his life here, and I don't think I've ever actually seen him do that before.
See, there's Doctor Who stories, I think, where the director is so used to like the studio thing that when they go out on film, even though it is single camera, they just kind of plop the camera down and just film something. And, you know, it's really exciting when you get, you know, someone like Graham Harper or Douglas Camfield did this a lot, like where they really embrace like the what the film camera lets them do.
I think David Maloney deserves a shout out in this conversation too.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff in the Deadly Assassin.
Like, was it Kenny McBain did Destiny of the Daleks? Where they, you know, they have that sort of kind of steady, like steady cam footage out on the. I know it's not a tremendously dynamic story at other points, but it's just there's some of that stuff that feels kind of.
It definitely loses points for sort of the suicide Daleks just going in zigzags, going exterminate, 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 while making no progress whatsoever.
That fast pan there, oh, this is.
Yeah, this is excellent, isn't it?
And look, he's right on the point of total exhaustion.
Running from right to left as well, which isn't the done thing. Ken Grieve, Destiny of the Daleks. That took me a moment.
Ken Grieve, yeah, sorry. Goodness, where did I get Kenny McBain from? Maybe it's. I think I've been rewatching a lot of Grange Hill recently, and his name's been in the credits a lot. Maybe I've ended up confusing him, but I feel like he has some sort of Doctor Who connection. Anyway, that's.
We'll blame Grange Hill for now.
Let's blame Grange Hill.
Yeah. Oh, the coat's mucky.
Yeah, mucky coat. That's a sign of.
Like that's how you know he's done for. It's not the cuts, it's not the poisoning. it's the fact that the BBC can't afford the bill to wash the coat.
Exactly.
I also like how it stays mucky as well in the Twin Dilemma. Mm-hmm. When you think about how the costume changed between Legopolis and Castrovalva. The costume and the location and everything changed right. Between Nicopolis and Castrovalva, but even just the smoke being pumped into the caves makes it seem like an entirely different set. I do love the fact that Jack, in his own way, very, very clearly really cares for Perry. Like, he really does not want any harm to come to this person. Perhaps for the wrong reasons, but that desperation just then, and sort of in all of this, it's just brilliant.
His willingness to give the Doctor what he needs at the end, just to save her life.
Like Morgus in the field. It would have been very easy to just keep him in that office and let him survive the story, and there'd have been some, oh, well, the worst of them all survives type thing about it. But I think it's actually great that they get him to the planet. He gets stuck in. Like, it's a last resort, but he will act if he needs to. A lot of Doctor Who villains would happily stay in the office.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no matter how desperate he gets, I can never see, let's say, Syl getting stuck in like that.
Oh, he blinked right there.
Ah, ruined the illusion.
I'm fair. I mean, that was like a 60-second shot.
It's almost like Graham Harper's testing him.
Another one.
But his blink at the end has been his one regret about his regeneration scene, because he wanted to do the Morgus thing of not blinking, and he doesn't quite make it to the end of his first sentence before, without blinking, and I think he always says he wishes he could retake that scene again, but it just wasn't the time.
It's taken a little while for this to happen, but these two are a great double act. It's another Robert Holmes double act.
Yeah, it's like a Robert Holmes double act, just with zero humor. Just like the anti-Jago and Lightfoot, isn't it?
Stotts kind of has that humor. I quite like it. He can be a little bit sardonic, whereas Morgus is the straightest of straight men. But
That's a great effect there, with the Doctor looking down on the mud burst.
Yeah, one of the few times that like keying two shots together looks completely convincing.
Yeah.
Here's another really, really nasty fight scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really down and dirty now. The one thing, it's a shame in a way we get to see Jack's face for a little bit after this, because his reaction here suggests something much worse than what you eventually see. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they were never going to realize that, were they?
Right.
I guess it's just TV grammar for just imagine this is 10 times worse than what you're seeing.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is doing wonders for his self-esteem, isn't it? Just
like,
totally.
Like, they're like basically doing like a handheld camera in a studio shot, like, backing it out like under a table like that. That's so,
it's genuinely inventive.
Yeah. Oh, I love this, the little unexpected coup. She's been waiting for this moment for so long.
I'm amazed Big Finish have never done a story where it turns out she's just as horrible. Because, of course, she has no interaction whatsoever with the Doctor, does she, in this?
No, she doesn't. It's just a one-upmanship game with Morgus.
Yeah, it'd be great to see or hear a sort of follow-up to, well, what does she do next? Again, Robert Holmes just leaves so much in there to build a world around, just little things, little characters, and, you know, there's definitely one there. There's so much implied about the society of Androzani Major that never really gets touched upon. You know, we never see it beyond these characters.
Where's our Big Finish Androzani spin-off series?
But yeah, I do love a little bit of background world building that can be sort of touched upon. And I know we have been to Androzani Major in Doctor Who Doing the Wardrobe, but again, we don't see it functioning as a society. We just see a forest.
That's just the weirdest place for an Androzani connection to turn up, isn't it, of all the stories?
But yeah, this is one of those stories where not everything kind of gets tied up in a nice, neat bow. Like, the conclusion of this story is the Doctor and Perry Perry at least, gets out of it. That's the conclusion of this story. But, you know, what happens next? Because after all of this, who controls the Spectrox? Is there any Spectrox left? Does the society collapse because there's no Spectrox left?
Yeah, you've just no idea. It's just the place has left a smoking ruin and the repercussions are unclear. And
yeah, this is not a, okay, Perry, we've saved the day. Now off we go in the TARDIS.
Yeah. So that's actually why I wouldn't want to return to this in spin-off material. Like, I think it's so effective that all we really get about the society is what we're seeing here. And there's enough to kind of have an idea how things work, but, you know, it's not like, take the robots series that Big Finish did, you know, or Caldor City. Like, there's all kinds of like room to explore that society, but I feel like here, like, this is just an environment for the Doctor and Perry to get lost and killed in, essentially. I don't think it's
independent. There would be a risk of retreading all that stuff with the final.
Right. And like, are you going to recapture this tone? Probably not. You know, I don't know.
Of course, they could have a story of society breaking down because it turns out everyone's addicted to Spectrox, and it could be called The Craves of Androzani.
Boo.
I thought that had changed Greg's mind entirely.
Look, the celery's kind of
rejected. Trying to figure out how to kick you out of this recording session.
I'm in charge.
Yeah, I know.
You'd just have to catch me killing your president to depose me.
I think I remember hearing that Davison had a really bad cold or flu or something when they filmed this. I wonder, did it help his, you know, did it help him kind of go inadvertently more method? Because if he's feeling out of sorts, he's able to play out of sorts more readily. But I think he's just such a good actor. He'd have made it.
I think this performance is just so good that there's no way any of it is accidental or coincidental. I think this is just really, really damn good acting.
Yeah.
Arguably the sort of strongest performance ever given by a Doctor at all. The sort of a real intensity there that I can't immediately think of being captured by anyone else. And this is from someone who's not the biggest Fifth Doctor fan in the world. Certainly not a Davison thing, just that it's not my favourite era is all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, definitely all of the Doctors have moments of, you know, serious intensity, but like to maintain it for four episodes and have this increasing sense of desperation, like there's no other story like this. There's no other story where the lead actor is asked to do things like this.
I mean, there's a reason this is the story we've chosen to do a commentary on, because it's just so notable for being unique. It'd be really interesting to do something that's just a bit run-of-the-mill, sort of Creature from the Pit or something like that.
Do we know what killed the Magma Beast? Was he shot, or did he just suffocate down there? What?
He just had an unlucky day.
Unlucky day.
I mean, I like to think it's not a mud burst, you know, with it being a magma beast and all. But it also seemed to be...
You know, Chillak sent so many men through there that they did just kill it.
One of them got lucky. It wasn't immune to bullets, it just needed like 700 to take it down. It's basically a video game boss.
Now, there's a very literal description for how crazy this episode is that ties in with what Davison's about to do, but you would lose your explicit no you would you would require an explicit tag, I think, if it was to be made.
Is it something I can bleep out?
Well, let's just say what he's about to extract there is...
Yes. I'm also glad that this is a fairly short sequence. Like, again, if this was a past era, this would be a six-parter, and
an entire episode would be just him trying to get the bat's milk. Yeah,
just traipsing through caves. It's, you know, 5 minutes and done. We don't need a really, really long quest through the caves to completely kill any of the pacing in this. A nice little montage sequence does it perfectly.
With that very haunting she's dying doctor replay over the top. That's what's in his head the whole time. And he's just...
Yeah. But if this was the Daleks, that would have been three episodes.
That's a really great insult, isn't it? You stinking awful, Morgus.
At one point, there would have been like a little chasm that, you know, he would have taken 5 minutes to... You know, nice run up and jump over it when he could have stepped over it.
That grin as he shoots Jack, like, this character is a proper psychopath.
Yeah, or when he killed his men in the last sequence.
Yes.
And I love the way Saladin just sort of almost like slides in there from the side of the doorway. It's
immensely brutal death for Morgus there.
This is tragic. He's only got his android to hold him for any sort of comfort.
His last moment, he just wants a hug.
Yeah.
Even that makeup on Nicola Bryant's legs is nasty. Like,
horrible. Yeah, that bat's milk must be really effective. Of course, it's milk, isn't it, rather than... Yes. Well, that's... then my joke from earlier doesn't really work. this run to the TARDIS, in my head, it's always longer than what you see here. I think it's just because the agonies that he's going through make it feel like an eternity that, you know, to get back there, but it's really just seconds on the screen.
I think there's also the fact that we spend a lot of time with that shot at the start of the first parter, and it's a near enough identical shot, isn't it? Sort of heading back towards the TARDIS. And he's out of there. Perry's safe, just in time, because the TARDIS would have got blown up otherwise.
Those explosions are so cool. Actually, what would have been the effect of the explosion going off under the parked TARDIS? Probably not much, really, because, you know.
Would it be sort of...
It just looks really cool.
Blasted away, like catapulted. And Perry gets all the milk. And there he is, on the floor.
Yep, and the blisters will be completely gone in a few seconds, so that stuff is really good.
And that's not the substance they were all scrapping over.
It's probably easier than having to spend like the next few stories like slowly, like having scars healing on Perry's legs.
It's always weird when you can see the doctor's fillings.
Yeah, did he regenerate those, or has he been to the dentist?
Lots of planets have a dentist.
But not an orthodontist.
I like the abstract regeneration sequence, but I prefer... Just a nice, straightforward.
apparently Graham Harper based this whole build-up thing on, it's a Beatles album, isn't it? It's a Beatles track. Day in the Life or something, is it?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely that like build-up to a epic, you know, climax of sound.
Yeah, that's what he took his inspiration from, or so he said in some interview, I think. I'm pretty sure that's what he said.
It's definitely a much better way of doing this sort of sequence than Legopolis, where it was just a couple of freeze-framed clips.
Although I love that too.
I do love it too, but I prefer the floating heads and actually getting the actors back. Colin's hair is so short.
Yeah, there's the blink.
And there's the... They have just pasted his face over Davison's, haven't they?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can still see the outline of Davison's face when Colin disappears.
Yeah, you've no idea how colourful it's going to get in the at the start of the next episode from that.
You think that was colourful? Wait until. So, are we all back to do Twin Dilemma next week then? Yeah?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
We would lose
considerably
the
drunker, but...
Yeah, we'd lose that not explicit tag pretty quickly, I think. That was excellent, though. That's as good as it's ever got.
Yeah, I mean...
I think it's got equally as good, but I don't think it's ever got better than that.
Yeah, I mean, that's held up as one of the greatest stories of all time for a reason, and there's no reason why it should ever not be considered such.
Yeah.
Yeah, a real game.
The only thing that would knock it out of the top 10 is if 9 other stories came along that were all as good or better, and I don't think that's going to happen.
So, yeah, I mean, it hasn't happened in 60 years, so.
Absolutely wonderful, that, though. Like, some of the best Doctor Who there has ever been. Some of the best performances, and not just Davison either. You know, the whole cast was completely on fire in that, and that's how most of the characters went out, actually. But, yeah, really, really wonderful piece. So just before we disappear off. This seems like a really big thing to ask. Summarize the caves of Androzani. Greg, do you want to go first?
I mean, I'm not going to give you a plot summary. We just watched it, but...
No, we don't need that. Yeah, Summarize your thoughts.
Yes. What can you say, really? It's a classic. I mean, it's one of the... To me, it is the best classic series story. Like, I don't think it, because of the production quality. Like, there are scripts that have been as good. There have been great performances in Doctor Who. There have been wonderfully filmed Doctor Who episodes. But this is 10 out of 10 in all of those areas. I mean, again, like, the only thing people have to complain about is that the magma beast looks terrible. And like, okay, that's, you know, it's Doctor Who. There's a terrible looking monster. Who cares? Like, it doesn't put a foot wrong. Like, every single member of the cast is on absolute top form. Like, it's maybe the best Doctor performance ever. It's one of the best companion performances ever. I mean, I don't really have anything to say about it other than just raving about how good it is and how good Graham Harper is directing it. And yeah, I mean, it's legendary, and I'm very thrilled that we got to watch it together.
Yeah, I think that's a great experience, actually, even though we're all on different land masses, aren't we? But it's been great to sort of watch it together like that and discuss it. And, you know, the magma beast, it is the only thing anybody can feasibly use to have a go at caves with. And it's not even the worst monster of the season. Like, in fact, it's one of the better monsters of the seasons. Are you honestly going to tell me that magma beast is worse than the Murker, than Mestor, than even the Tractators, I think the Tractators are actually quite good by 80s Doctor Who standards, but they're certainly on a par with the Magma Beast in terms of quality and realisation. Mark, what are your sort of final thoughts on Caves?
Yeah, it's a big question. It's maybe the best way to sort of put it for me is for a long time, when I was really getting into Doctor Who fandom, you know, and watching these, you know, catching up on a lot of the stories properly for the first time on VHS, this I was absolutely certain for a long time would be my all-time favorite Doctor Who story for a long time. And then Castor Valva surpassed it, because that story, Castor Valva, hits me on it just resonates with me on a much more personal level in ways I'll not go into right now. But this thing, you know, objectively, I think you'd have to look at it and say all the things Greg said. You know, it's Doctor Who done on a, it's just like playing in a completely different league in terms of what it's doing, how it's been executed, how the shots are being done, the inventiveness of, it's so dynamic. And I'm so, the Davison era is my favorite era, and I'm just so glad that it's bookended so strongly. You know, the fact that for a while it was a toss-up between whether Castor Valva or Anders Annie was my favorite story says a lot, because his era starts so memorably and it ends so memorably. And no matter what you think of what comes in between, and I personally rate nearly everything in the Davison era very highly, but I know a lot of people find it, you know, a bit so-so and a bit beige and all that, but you'd find very few people who couldn't argue that Anders Annie is just right up there with the very, very best, and probably certainly the best story of the 80s, I'd say many would say, and maybe the best story in terms of production and everything coming together in just the right way that there's been in that original run. It's powerful. It's just so good.
I think it's fair to say that the overwhelming thing about Caves is Graham Harper's direction, but that isn't to take away, like you say, from everything else. It's one of Robert Holmes's best scripts. It is Davison's best performance. Let's not mess about it. It is Davison's best performance. It's Davison playing the Doctor he wanted to. But I think the thing about Graham Harper is he's just great at everything. Like, there are directors who are absolutely brilliant in the studio. There are directors who are great on location. There are directors who are great with the slow building tension-y type stuff. There are directors who are pretty good with the action type stuff. This just has everything, and Graham Harper gets every single thing right. Every single shot, every single bit of lighting, the positioning, everything is just absolutely spot on right to create something really brilliant and special here.
And you can see the trust that the actors have in him, because what he gets out of them, he's an actor's director. I think that's been said about him a number of times. You know, people just love working with him. If you take somebody like Peter Grimwade, who, you know, got a really pretty dynamic direction into Earthshock, for instance, like he did a really good job there. But the stories of the actors in terms of how he got that done, he seemed to rub everybody up the wrong way at some point. Whereas you sense that Harper and the actors are all sort of simpatico, and it's like they're working together. It's not this combative kind of thing to get a result that the director wants. It's like he somehow has everybody on board, and they're all so engaged with it, and it just creates this momentum and energy and everything else. And it's really
I think you're right. I think the real difference is Grimwade kind of got the performances he wanted out of the actors, whereas Harper worked with the actors to get those performances. Earthshock is a hell of an achievement in terms of early 80s TV, the way that that's directed, the pace of that final episode, just the sheer number of shots that are in part four is a hell of an achievement. But everything suggests that Caves was a much happier production. It is a better production. I love Earthshock, but Caves is definitely the better of the two. I don't think there's any arguing with that.
And just a final sort of shout out for, I mentioned him briefly last week, but Roger Lim's music for that.
Yes.
Just the way his music saturates, it's it would be a difficult listen kind of just as an isolated score, but combined with the visuals, it just saturates the whole thing in the most perfect doomy way imaginable. And I know again, Harper asked him to rework what he'd originally submitted for the story and said, look, can you just rework this? And that was the result. And it just goes to show you everybody put the extra mile for him. Because I guess Lim could have turned around and said, no, that's what I'm giving you. But he'd obviously enthused him so much that he was willing to go back and rework the score and give him more of what he wanted. And the rest of, you know, the whole thing speaks for itself, that he was right to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think every decision that went into that was the right one. And I don't think it's reasonable to drag it down based on the Magma Beast alone, which is something that does get thrown around for fandom. But yeah, what an absolutely great story, and what an absolutely great experience sort of watching it and sharing it with you guys. So thank you very, very much for that. That is all we have time for, though. So we'll be back next week with our 100th ever episode. This is number 99.
Wow.
I know. It's flown by. So next week we're doing something a little bit special for our 100th ever episode. But in the meantime, I will say goodbye and thank you to Greg.
Goodbye and thank you. I've enjoyed this a lot.
And goodbye and thank you to Mark.
Goodbye. I've had a great time. Thanks. Bye.
And we'll be back for more podcasting soon. Goodbye now.